Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
All right. Welcome to Forum, Nature Biotechnology's podcast, where we speak with leading researchers in the field about their work, about recent papers, or sometimes just general topics of interest. My name is Brady Huggett, and today we have a show on genetic screening with CRISPR. And this discussion was run by Marcus Elsner, senior editor at Nature Biotechnology, and he's with me now. So I think the first thing we want to talk about, Marcus, is why this topic? Why do a podcast on genetic screening using CRISPR as a tool?
Yeah, over the last year or so, there have actually been quite a lot of developments in using CRISPR tools for screening. CRISPR screening itself was invented relatively quickly after the tools themselves were discovered. And initially, that was all based either on generating gene knockouts using CRISPR nucleases, or activating or inactivating whole genes using approaches called CRISPR-I or CRISPR-A. Now, people have turned to the latest generation of CRISPR tools, base editors and prime editors, and have applied those to make much more defined changes in the genome, even making individual base mutations to get a very fine-grained understanding of what mutations, for example, in cancer, actually do.
And how do we decide on the guests for the show?
So John Dunge is one of the pioneers of the whole CRISPR screening field. He, in 2016, published really a landmark paper, I think, in Nature Biotech, presenting the first highly optimized library for doing CRISPR screening, both in human and in mouse cells. And then Kimberly Stegmeier, she's one of the most prominent users of CRISPR screening to elucidate mechanisms of cancer development, cancer maintenance, immune escape, things like this. And she's also involved in the Cancer Dependency Map project, which is a really systematic effort of a large number of groups to systematically investigate dependencies of cancers to find new leads for drug development, to prioritize known drugs for clinical trials, and maybe ultimately even to use the knowledge to prioritize drugs for individual patients once their genome has been, or the cancer genome has been sequenced, although this might be a few years in the future.
They call that the depth map, is that right?
That's the depth map, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's all we need. So here is episode 13 of Forum.
Yeah, so Kim and John, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. And I think the first question I'm going to ask is, what is genetic screening and what do we do when we do a genetic screen?
Sure. So, you know, for as long as I've been a professional scientist, we've had the sequence of the human genome, and it was pretty quickly clear that we don't know what most genes are doing. I would say that's still the case, even though we've been working on it for 20 years. And functional genomics is how do we get at that question? And obviously the lessons from genetics in model organisms has been to break genes and figure out how the phenotype changes. So that's exactly what we're trying to do. But now not studying people. Obviously, there's a whole field of human genetics that looks for that. But in model systems that we can manipulate. And you know, CRISPR is the tool of choice to do that now. But it's hardly the first tool that we've had to do that job.
Yeah, I think Kim was telling me how she learned about the previous tool of choice. And so what did we use before?
Sure. So, you know, Marcus, I can very vividly remember when I was a postdoctoral fellow in Todd Golub's lab, and we were having lab meeting at the Dana-Farber at the time, and Todd came in very excited. It was, I'm going to say 2001, and he had a paper from the Tuschel lab at Max Planck that described the application of RNAi technology to mammalian cells. And Todd passed the paper out. I still have that copy. It's yellowed and marked up with a highlighter. And he said to us, you know, this is going to change the way that we do science. And of course, our focus is on cancer. You know, and at the time, we really couldn't manipulate genes systematically in terms of inducing their repression or certainly their knockout at the time. You know, and Todd said, you know, can you imagine how we could use this technology? And it's such a memorable moment because, you know, it was just field changing, the fact that we can now one by one manipulate each gene potentially in the genome. And so, you know, I remember the first project that we actually talked about, and this was a project that was led by Ben Ebert in our lab. You know, so chromosome gains and losses are very common in cancer, of course. And we were studying leukemia and myelodysplastic syndrome, and there's a recurrent abnormality on 5q. And it was not clear, like, what is, you know, or the gene or the genes on that chromosome. And the idea here was to use RNAi to repress one by one the genes in that region, and then ask what it did to differentiation. And this really led to the discovery of RPS14 as a critical gene in that region. And this, again, was work led by Ben Ebert. But just the ability now to do this to scale was tremendous.
Yeah, I think very quickly, people started to really develop large libraries that you could use to knock down hundreds or even genome-wide all genes. But when CRISPR came along in 2013, people very quickly, like within a year, started to move away from siRNA to CRISPR. Why was that? What was the big advantage of using CRISPR?
Yeah, so I think there's two parts to that. First is, you know, we should recognize that the CRISPR technology was able to build off of all the hard lessons learned from doing screens with RNAi. You know, you mentioned that RNAi libraries were built, Marcus. Yes, they absolutely were, but we didn't have large-scale pooled synthesis yet. We didn't have Illumina sequencing. So all those original screens were read out via microarray, which was really challenging. And so your ability to iterate was a lot slower in the early 2000s than it was now. But really what made CRISPR so attractive and why the field essentially immediately switched to using CRISPR is it turned out to be far more specific. So RNAi screens, have a fairly substantial off-target problem. That doesn't mean it's unsolvable. It doesn't mean that every experiment done with RNAi was incorrect. But it does mean that you need to be a lot more careful and thorough with RNAi than you do with CRISPR. CRISPR just gives much clearer answers much faster, and so very quickly became the tool of choice.
And I guess it shares one advantage is that you only need to a relatively small RNA to be designed compared to other tools. Yeah, I remember in the same issue that we published our first CRISPR papers, we had a genome-wide TALEN library for the human genome. But I think that just never got used because it was just wrong timing.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting to think about, you know, what if, you know, there's no reason that RNAi needed to be discovered before CRISPR, but and then TALENs in between. You know, what would the development look like if those had been discovered in different orders? Interesting conversation over a beer. But the point you make, Marcus, about the small size being able to read out, that's also what made the transition from RNAi to CRISPR so easy. I mean, in many of my slides, I just changed shRNA to sgRNA, and everything still held. So again, we could rapidly adapt that, and it went.
Is shRNA still used? I mean, Kim, maybe in cancer biology, or is that just a totally dead technology?
No, so it is still used. I think, as John said, you know, you have to be really careful about the question of off-target effects. You have to have proper rescues. You need multiple SHs. But I think one of the disadvantages to using CRISPR is it's a relatively binary system, particularly if you're looking at knockout of the target, right? So, you know, the target's present, you get HETs or you get homozygous deletion, and you don't get a dose-responsive effect using CRISPR-Cas9 cutting. And so sometimes there's an advantage, you know, in using RNAi if you're trying to look at partial repression of your target versus complete knockout. You know, of course, there are new approaches, and I know John is working on one of these because we're working with him on this together. You know, the idea of using tunable CRISPR-based approaches with CRISPR-I, you know, as another alternative. But we like in our lab, when we identify a target, to use multiple orthogonal approaches, and sometimes we still will use RNAi, but again, being really careful about having all the right controls.
Yeah, and in addition, you know, and CRISPR-I is absolutely, as Kim mentioned, a wonderful technology if you don't want a pure knockout, but you want a tuned gene expression. But it's also worth mentioning that, you know, one home that RNAi might still have is all you need to deliver is a small RNA, whereas with CRISPR technology, delivering or pre-engineering your cells to express a large Cas protein, in some of the more complex model systems, that's really hard and maybe even not really possible to do, you know, especially if you want to work with fresh tumors or organoid models or whatnot. That's where, you know, a well-constructed RNAi experiment might actually be the right first thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So again, people moved very quickly to designing genome-wide libraries for CRISPR. So those early libraries probably had issues. So what kind of issues did people encounter when they started to applying CRISPR knockouts on a large scale?
Yeah, I'd say initially, you know, first off, I mean, I remember where I was sitting and who I was talking to when we got our first results, and it was a definite hugs and high five moment. So, you know, even out of the box, yeah, it was clear that CRISPR is going to be a game changer. But it was also clear that, you know, these libraries were pretty big, and being able to reduce the scale, you know, we didn't know what we were doing when it came to designing guides, especially how do you select guides that work from those that don't. And, you know, we knew from the RNAi literature that, yeah, they're likely to be sequence features that make for better siRNAs than others. And, you know, why wouldn't the same be true with CRISPR? And of course, it turned out to be the case. And I think it was really with an eye towards large-scale systematic studies, such as the dependency map, that we realized this is where it's going to be impactful. You know, if you're doing one screen every 3 years, whether your library has 120,000 things in it or 80,000 things or 40,000 things, that doesn't make too much of a difference. But if you want to systematically apply CRISPR, and at this point, you know, the number of screens that we've been engaged in is not even in the hundreds, it's now in the thousands. Those efficiency gains really start to add up. And I think, you know, the work that Kim has done with the pediatric DepMap is a great example of that.
Mm-hmm. Before we talk about the DepMap, which is, I think the next topic on the list, is the reason why we're talking today is that it's, well, now a bit more than 5 years ago that, John, you published that Ivana and Asagio paper with us. So how did you go about differently designing that library than what people had done before?
Yeah, so that was a paper where we really, for the first time, we had tried to figure out, well, what are the rules that lead to good guide RNAs versus bad guide RNAs? And again, you know, Kim was mentioning her yellowed copy of an original paper. I've got my marked up version of a Nature Biotech paper from, let's see, 2004. Rational siRNA Design for RNA Interference, which was published by Anastasia Kurova and colleagues. And it was, you know, it's a wonderfully marked up paper of here's how to go about figuring out how to optimize the technology. And that was a very important paper in my scientific development. It was, well, let, do this, but for CRISPR. So we generated rules. You know, we generate a lot of guide RNAs. We measure their activity, and we figure out what are the sequences that help or harm activity. In the paper that you're mentioning, Marcus, we collaborated with Microsoft Research to apply the latest in machine learning to that problem. And it's a field that obviously continued to develop, and we're getting better and better at guide RNA design. I think we're starting to asymptote from the standpoint of there's probably not a heck of a lot more juice to be squeezed out of that lemon. You know, we're really good at it now. But again, it was all towards the eye of how do we just make screening these things more efficient so that, you know, numbers of cells don't become limiting, cost doesn't become a driving factor. You know, how can we just get away with smaller and smaller libraries and still get really good coverage of what's happening in the genome?
How did you come up with the names? It's was it Havana, Siaggio, Brunello, and Brie.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, the humans are named after wine, the mice are named after cheeses, and importantly, we do the empirical test to make sure that they pair well together. So, you know, we go through many, many wines to find the right ones. It's hard work, but someone's got to do it.
Yeah, no, I feel you. Yeah, if you need volunteers the next time, I'm happy to help. So Kim, you used I think especially the Havana library in quite a few of your papers. How did you go about selecting the library? Was that a difficult process? Was it obvious that those were the ones to use?
Right. No, it's a great question, Mark. So, you know, again, a little bit of history. So back in around 2015, Todd Golub, Charlie Roberts, who was at the time at Dana-Farber, he's now the head of St. Jude's Cancer Center, and Paquita Vasquez, who is a research scientist at the Broad and has played a leading role in the dependency map. We got together to talk about, you know, a challenge in pediatric oncology, which is that the diseases tend to have relatively quiet genomes. They tend to be less responsive to traditional targeted therapies because they don't have the same panel of mutations as adult cancers. And to date, have not been as responsive to newer agents like immune checkpoint inhibitors. So there's a real need to find new targets in pediatric cancer. And the work on the dependency map had largely focused on adult cancers, but was really revealing exciting targets. And we felt like, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if we could have an effort focused on childhood cancers? And so we all got together and we talked about the possibility of developing a pediatric cancer dependency map. But we felt very strongly that the power of doing this would be if we could fully integrate the data with all of the beautiful data that had been generated in adult cancers. And so because that work had been done with the Havana Library largely at that time, we felt like it was really important to integrate the pediatric effort fully with adult effort, so that we could have the scope and scale of comparing the pediatric cancers to their adult counterparts. And so that's what we did. Mm-hmm. We said, you know, this is going to be much more seamless if it's fully integrated with the ongoing efforts at the Broad at the time. And no regrets. I mean, I think that was the right decision.
So maybe you can explain what the cancer dependency map is and how that relies on CRISPR screening.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the cancer dependency map is a very large scale effort to identify, as said, dependencies in cancers, to really understand what are the key genes that either disease types depend on or molecular subtypes of cancer depend on. And it's a multifaceted effort that has a number of different nodes. So one aspect of the cancer dependency map has been to bring in large collections of cancer models, mostly to date cancer cell lines, but growing collection now of minimally passaged models, organoids, lines derived from patient-derived xenograft models, and to perform omics on them. And so initially, largely whole exome sequencing was performed and RNA sequencing was performed. And now that's being expanded to whole genome. And in a pediatric focused effort, we're really excited to explore more epigenetic features of these different cancer models. And so that's been one part of it, is really getting a well-vetted collection of models and performing omics. The second has been the genetic perturbation efforts, which have to date initially started focusing with RNAi and now more recently focusing on CRISPR screening. And here, of course, the idea is one by one, you can delete each gene in the genome and then ask, what does that do to these various cancer models? You know, does that have a deleterious effect on growth? Does it have an advantageous effect on growth over time? So that's kind of another arm. And then there's also a small molecule arm to this effort that's been focused on PRISM screening, where cancer cell lines are barcoded and then pooled and then screened against collections of small molecules. And I mean, to me, this is just a treasure trove of data.
Yeah, and I guess the CRISPR screening data then could also be used to prioritize new molecules to develop drugs against. I guess that's one of the ideas as well.
Absolutely. And that's been one of the focuses of the work that we've been doing in childhood cancer, mm-hmm. is to say, you know, these cancers tend to have quiet genomes. And one of the first questions was, well, do they have fewer dependencies or fewer potential cancer therapeutic targets? And the answer there was no, that the pediatric cancers have actually as many unique dependencies if you compare that cancer to all the other cancers that were screened, as do the adult cancers, which for us in peds is really exciting. And we also found that the pediatric cancers tend to have unique dependencies that aren't seen in adult cancer. And I think beyond the notion of finding drug targets, we're just learning an awful lot about the biology of these tumors that we didn't know before this approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the DepMap as, you know, obviously as a discovery engine is great, but as even just a foundational resource is really critical. I mean, the world of cell lines has forever essentially been really fraught, but now we have, you know, really good characterization and a lookup table. I mean, the DepMap website, depmap.org, is the first place I go whenever I want to look up something about any new gene. Or now, as Kim was saying, you know, a small molecule, a lot of data is collated there. And it's really been through, you know, large scale, long term efforts, not only at the Broad, also colleagues at the Sanger in the UK have been, you know, running some parallel and very nicely integrated efforts, I would say. You know, we've made both institutions have really committed to keeping each other in the loop. And we've had a lot of wonderful conversations of how to integrate data. And make sure that, you know, they're not just two independent DepMap efforts, mm-hmm. But that, you know, we're really building a data set that talks to each other and leverages each other's insight.
Marcus, one of the things I'll say is, you know, it is such a highly collaborative effort, you know, as John just, you know, said. I think that's, to me, been one of the tremendous things about DepMap is it's really bringing in expertise across so many different disciplines and people working together to make the data, to use the data, and kind of an iterative back and forth about how to do better. And the data is made public. I think that's another really unusual, special, and important feature of the DepMap is that it's made public now before, you know, people even potentially have a chance to publish on their cell lines, mm-hmm. per se, right? We feel it's so important for the community to have this data, you know, for these patients with cancer that we have to all work together. So, you know, it's been a real privilege to be a part of this effort. Mm-hmm.
So can the data be used for clinical decision-making? So you have a child with cancer that you sequence the genome. So is the data useful for making treatment decisions?
So that it's an interesting question. I would say we're not quite at the point where we're making actual treatment decisions, but we are using it to inform clinical trial decisions, right? And so I think, again, one of the strengths to having this data in the public domain is that pharmaceutical companies can also mine the data, you know, and if there is a targeted therapy that's being developed for an adult indication, for example, one can now readily go and look at that data and say, well, are there other disease indications? And of course, I'm very focused on pediatrics, mm-hmm. you know, are there potentially pediatric indications? And you can then use that as a hypothesis generating tool to now go test and validate potentially that compound in models of that disease of interest. So I think that's been one really important application. And that's definitely been the case. We've had, you know, pharmaceutical companies call us up to say, hey, you know, we have this compound, this target, it looks interesting in pediatric cancer X. You know, would you be interested in collaborating with us on that? And so, you know, I think that's been a real gain for the pediatric cancer community. I think the second piece is the idea of finding new biomarkers, right? And so, you know, I think one nice example, you know, I like to use examples that are proof of concept. You know, there's been a lot of interest in a target known as menin in pediatric and adult leukemias that have MLL rearrangements. If you look at DevMap data and you say, where is there the strongest dependency on menin? It is in MLL rearranged leukemias in DevMap. If you look at kind of the next closest neighbor, it's a type of AML that has mutations in a gene known as NPM1. And now clinically that has been shown. And in additional lab models, that NPM1 mutant AML also tends to be more dependent on menin and responsive to menin inhibition. So the DepMap actually could have uncovered that, right? And so I think using DepMap also as a tool for identifying potential biomarkers is another, you know, in the kind of realm of clinic. Again, you wouldn't use it as immediately, oh, now I'm going to give this drug to this patient. But I think it informs hypotheses in the clinic and also new targets, right? So, you know, there are certainly efforts now to develop new small molecules based on targets that are emerging from DepMap, both in adults and children.
Yeah, and much harder to quantitate is how many, you know, how many false leads were prevented by looking at DepMap and immediately saying like, oh, wait a minute, this is a hypothesis that's not going to generalize. We shouldn't develop this project any further. Hard to quantitate, but that's a really valuable, wasting time.
One concept that in CRISPR screening that I always find quite fascinating is the concept of synthetic lethality. So for that, you need combinatorial screens to find synthetic lethal interactions. And I know that that's not always trivial to do. So what are the challenges in knocking out two or more genes at the same time?
Yeah, there's a number of challenges. Some are on the more technical side of how do you successfully deliver multiple reagents into the same cell at the same time and have them both work. And you know, we've been working on this for a while. Cas9 can be a way to get there. Actually, I'm personally more of a fan of using Cas12a, which was previously known as CPF1, because the native biology of that system is sort of more readily amenable to multiplexing. But either, regardless of how you get there, technically, the bigger challenge is 20,000 squared is 400 million hypotheses of potential pairwise combinations of tech. So how do you, you know, assuming you're just not going to, you know, start at the top and go all the way down, how do you nominate hypotheses for what combinations to explore in the first place? Certainly, there's been a lot of progress made just in the last couple years of looking at paralogs, which I view as a sort of its own version of synthetic lethality. Obviously, if two genes have pretty similar sequence, there's a good chance that there's some functional redundancy. But that's very important to look at. I mean, if you only look at the DepMap, you would have no idea that MAP kinase is important in cancers, because in the vast majority of cases, you actually need to hit both MAPK1 and MAPK3, which are ERK2 and ERK1. You need to hit them both. And so you miss that when doing screens of only single gene knockouts at a time. So just the ability to even say, okay, we're going to target paralogs and understand what might make for a better drug target, I think there's a lot to be discovered there. But then there's the other version, I don't know if I'd call this truer synthetic lethality, but more serendipitous synthetic lethality, which is the poster child, and there's really no other faces on that poster right now, is BRCA1 and PARP1. Where you have two genes that don't share any evolutionary history, but you know, are in pathways, both of which are required. Or if you lose both of them, then the cell is dead. So how do we in a systematic way discover more BRCA PARP interactions? I think that is something that is very much an open question.
Hmm. Are there other examples like in the preclinical realm where CRISPR or otherwise discovered synthetic lethal interactions have been at least tested in clinical trials?
So I think probably the best examples of that are, again, maybe a sort of side version of synthetic lethality are the collateral damage genes. So if a cell loses, you know, it lost this chromosome arm in order to get rid of this tumor suppressor, but then it also lost some other genes in the process, and that provides a, you know, can provide a therapeutic window. So that's a version of synthetic lethality adjacent, I would say. Mm-hmm. And there are several of those hypotheses that are now moving towards the clinic.
And sometimes, Marcus, even within the context of current DepMap data, you know, for example, we found a target that's more highly relevant in pediatric cancer compared to other, and we were focusing on neuroblastoma known as NXT1. And when you mine the data, again, this was a single gene DepMap type screen. When you mine the data, you do see that poor expression of NXT2, which is paralog, renders sensitivity to NXT1. So depending on the target of interest, you can actually sometimes use DepMap data to identify those types of synthetic lethal relationships, more typically in the paralogs, but you can sometimes infer that or hypothesize that from the data itself.
I've been working with, how many cell lines do you say it has DepMap screened so far, cancer cell lines? It must be
this point, it's got to be over 1,000. Is that right, Kim?
Yeah, it's at least over 800. That's the last number I had in my slides. Yeah. But it's pushing 1,000.
Yeah. So we have definitely now probably passed, in science, 1,000 or more different cell types and organisms that have been screened. How big are the differences in CRISPR performance when you look at all those different cancer cell lines, other organisms? So is there a lot of optimization to be done for each individual system, or is it you get relatively good performance across systems?
Yeah, so there I'd say every model is its own story. I mean, certainly from a DepMap standpoint, there's several QC steps that any particular cell model needs to go through before it gets screened. And, you know, there's attrition there. And so, you know, we're over time accumulating sets of cells that we have been unable to screen in DepMap. And, you know, maybe each one is its own story. Maybe it's a question of, you know, is expression of Cas9 particularly toxic in those cells or problematic in some other way? Obviously, delivery is another issue. There are many cell types for which lentiviral delivery, the method of choice for these screens, you know, whether it's due to an innate immune response or whatever the case may be, you know, if you can't transduce the cells, then you can't really do the screen. So yeah, there are definitely fail modes, but I think from a DepMap perspective, it's not necessarily a fail mode, but a future direction is there are still so many cancer genotypes that are poorly represented in DepMap. And I'm sure Kim can speak a lot more to those limitations and just how much farther there is to go.
I totally agree with that, John. I mean, in the case of peds, we started with a focus on largely solid tumors and some brain tumor models and some heme malignancy, but it was more dominated by solid tumors. And it was based on availability of cell lines that infect well, that grow well in culture and 2D. And of course, local interest in the diseases in our local community. But we're now, you know, really planning a next generation pediatric cancer dependency map to try to get at, you know, the subtypes that were not well represented in terms of molecular subtypes, but also diseases that were not well represented. And so for many of the brain tumors, for example, we don't have 2D lines that are representative of primary tumors. And rather, in that case, neurospheres do a better job, we think, of modeling primary patient disease. And so there's an effort now with the Broad to try to develop ways to screen neurospheres. And whether that's going to be genome scale or we're going to have to develop smaller, more focused libraries is still a question. Similarly, for some of the heme malignancies, some of these models, they don't infect well or they don't tolerate Cas9 very well. And so there's going to be another effort focused on the high-risk pediatric leukemia subsets to figure out what's the way that we can actually effectively screen these models. So a lot more to do. And, you know, some of the disease types are just not well represented by traditional 2D cell line models.
I guess most of the screens that are generally done are in some way or another connected to cell proliferation or cell death. How can we screen for more complex phenotypes? For example, interactions with immune cells, morphology. So yeah, I guess we need different approaches to screen for these kinds of phenotypes.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's been a lot of progress on numerous fronts for, you know, higher dimensionality readouts. You know, viability is an easy thing, relatively easy thing to screen for. And, you know, it integrates a lot of what the cell is doing, but you don't get a lot of insight into why, right? You know, you just know whether the cell is there or not. So certainly flow cytometry-based screens were pretty quickly adapted for CRISPR-based pooled approaches, because for a pooled screen, at least, you just need to physically separate the cells you care about from the ones that you don't. And flow cytometry is well suited to that. Although I should say, you know, a flow cytometry screen is a big technical challenge. It is not something that most people get right on the first try. So it's in the realm of like definitely doable, and you can make them work. And when they work, they're great. But there's often a lot more under the surface of trial and error to get those to go. But in terms of high dimensional readouts, obviously single cell RNA-seq using approaches like CropSeq or PerturbSeq, which are all aiming to get at the same thing, there you get a single cell RNA profile of your perturbation. I mean, those technologies were first published, I think, in 2016 or so. There, you know, the readout is high dimensional, but cost is still a substantial consideration for, you know, you can't really do that genome-wide routinely by any means. So readouts like that, readouts like you mentioned optical screening. So this is the idea where the readout is an image rather than cell abundance. So Paul Blaney, a colleague at the Broad, has been helping to lead that field. There, the idea is you take your pooled library, you put it onto cells, and you examine cell morphology with whatever stains you might want to use. And then you determine what guide RNA triggered that morphology by in situ sequencing. So you know that, okay, this cell has an interesting phenotype, and then that you visualize, and then you do rounds of in situ sequencing to determine what guide RNA was in that cell. That is a fairly nascent technology. It was only first described a couple of years ago. And you know, the scale up for that and the equipment required is certainly something that is non-trivial. But at the same time, there are a lot of questions you can ask with an imaging-based approach, especially about, as you said, Marcus, you know, cell-cell interactions, you know, where there's just no obvious way to do it outside of imaging. And then I'll make a pitch for a paper that was published in, I think, Science just last month on a new flow cytometry approach where you can, you know, really crank up the ability of what a flow cytometer can interpret to not just, you know, fluorescent levels, but really some very, very fine-grained analysis. And, you know, it's just one paper, but I'm really excited by the possibilities that offers.
Yeah. So, Marcus, I agree. I mean, there in the dropout screen, you don't, you know, it's very useful, but you don't know what the phenotype really is. And so in one project, we evaluated, you know, the top roughly 200 genes that were depleted in neuroblastoma, which is a pediatric solid tumor. Of neural crest origin. And we said, you know, what we most care about in this case are genes that when depleted actually lead to cell death. And so we developed a secondary screen. We had a library and developed a secondary screen using annexin selection with a bead-based approach. And that worked extremely well. We also said, you know, we want to make sure that the targets are valid in vivo before we start going too deep into any one target. And so we had a series of secondary assays where we did annexin selection, in vivo screening, and then also use CRISPR-I as an orthogonal approach for target validation. And that worked very well. We've also gotten excited about these positive selection flow-based screens, particularly around targets of immunotherapy in pediatrics. And so, you know, in neuroblastoma, there's a ganglioside GD2 that's expressed on the surface of cells. That's a target of an antibody-based therapy known as dinutuximab. And we got interested in what regulates GD2 expression. And so did a genome scale CRISPR screen looking at, you know, cells that gain GD2, cells that lose GD2 by flow sorting. And it's absolutely beautiful data. It's who's who in chromatin complexes. And so we're sold on these positive selection screens. We're also using them to study fusions, to ask what regulates fusion oncoproteins in pediatric cancers. And that's a very common theme in childhood cancers, are transcription factor fusions. So lots more exciting screens to be done.
It's interesting to hear that in vivo screens have now become really feasible. I guess that must still be quite a logistical challenge, but is that something that is in the realm of possibility, at least for larger labs now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's an effort here, Eric Brode, led by Rob Manguso and Kathleen Yates, that have building off of some work done originally in Nick Haining's group to look at what are genes you can modulate in a tumor that affect response to checkpoint inhibitors. And the original screen was published in, I think, 2016, 2017. That identified a target, PTPN2, that is now being clinically pursued, a clinical trial starting this year on that as a target, which was, you know, directly identified from a CRISPR screen. There are absolutely challenges of doing screens in mice. You know, I don't think one's first screen should be a genome-wide approach in mice. That sounds like a bad idea. But it is something where if you're systematic about it, you know, doing everything at once, bad idea. But breaking it up and you know, prosecuting different parts of the genome over time, I think is a, you know, numerous groups have now shown that to be a wonderful strategy. A colleague, Kristen Naus, over at MIT, has done a very nice screen genome-wide in mouse liver, looking at as a model of regeneration. There are screens now being done to look at CAR T cell phenotypes, which, you know, you almost certainly have to do that in vivo. So it's definitely something where, you know, if the biology requires that you need to do it in vivo, it's certainly possible to do it. It requires optimization, but the path is there for sure.
It's interesting to hear that you can also move look at phenotypes beyond cancer, like you mentioned with the liver regeneration. I think that that's also probably quite interesting, also for neuroscience. Also reminds me of April 1st paper that Fyodor Urnov and I always want to write, as the simultaneous all gene knockout in mice. So I think one thing that I also find quite interesting is that now, I think over the last year or two, we've been moving beyond knockouts with the development of base editor screens and now probably prime editor screens. So where do you see the role of those a bit newer approaches, in maybe first in cancer and then maybe also in other fields?
Yeah, so there, you know, going, it's just a finer resolution of the genome, right? I mean, if one question is, what does a gene do? And you're asking it at that level of, you know, several thousand bases of information as one unit. Now we have technologies that allow you to get down to, well, what does one base do? And, you know, certainly that's the next frontier of human genetics. We've done a really good job categorizing what are all the SNPs that people can have that add up in one way, shape, or form to give risk to some disease, but what to do about that is still very much unclear in the vast majority of cases. And so I would imagine that, you know, these technologies you mentioned, base editors as an example, that allows you to, you know, more or less change one base at a time into another base and see how the cell is different. So the approaches for how to do the screens will be the same. I mean, everything that we were just talking about whether we're doing a flow-based screen or an imaging screen, whatever the case may be, those technologies plug into that really well. You're just asking a much more focused question. You know, I have no interest in doing a 3 billion, you know, change every single base in the genome library. I will not be making that library anytime soon.
So, Kim, do you think that could help if we think again about maybe patient care? When we sequence a genome, there are all those variants of unknown significance that are found, I think, in every cancer genome. Do you think that might help to make sense of those?
Absolutely. When you asked what the applications might be, that was the first that came to mind for me as, you know, somebody who does cancer research, that, you know, we've been involved in our lab with Jana Pickman, who is training in my lab now, is really leading this effort to look at, in high-risk pediatric leukemias, can we match genetic changes in that leukemia to targeted therapies? And this is a question that comes up not infrequently, that there's a gene that's known to be recurrently mutated. We see a novel mutation. It's a variant of uncertain significance. And what do? And you could imagine using assays for transformation coupled with a base editing type screening approach focused on specific genes of interest as another tool to try to validate more broadly these variants. So I think absolutely it's an exciting approach for that indication.
And it's a huge goal to have a catalog of what, you know, every possible base change in the human genome leads to, but it is still finite. It's not like chasing COVID variants where we just have no idea what's going to come next. It's a solvable challenge. And, you know, I think that there's been wonderful work from Jay Shendure's lab using gene editing approaches to build that lookup table for BRCA1. These are laborious screens, but, you know, they need to be, if they're done well and they're done once, now we know. And then we have that lookup table. And over time, we just need to do that for, you know, pretty much everything. But it's a finite and ultimately achievable goal.
I think that brings me to my last question. And so if you had one wish in CRISPR biology or screening that a fairy could grant, what would you ask the CRISPR fairy to do?
I don't know. I haven't seen David Liu in a couple of days. Next time I go.
Yeah, I think now he has his nickname.
For me, I'll go in a different direction from what my research does, but I think the therapeutic application of CRISPR is just tremendously exciting. There's going to be so many things that we'll be able to manipulate with CRISPR technology that, you know, you just can't really fathom a way to get there with other therapeutic modalities. But their delivery just remains such a tremendous challenge. So, you know, we can do a lot with delivery to cell types that we know how to hit, like the liver or, you know, stem cells that you can remove, edit, and put back in. But there's a whole host of organs where, you know, we're still pretty far from being able to do that in a controllable way. So I think if the CRISPR fairy can figure out how to make delivery to any cell type of interest as trivial as possible, I think that's going to have just tremendous real-world impact.
Marcus, I have to say that was my same CRISPR fairy. You know, and specifically, you can imagine, you know, I said fusions are very common in pediatric cancer. And so you have a unique opportunity to potentially target, right, that fusion. It's not present in other normal cells. But the delivery question is a really tricky one, you know, or regions of amplification, right, where you have both the on-target and the off-target DNA damage. In that context, that could actually be therapeutically very relevant with a high therapeutic window. But again, like, can we deliver this approach in solid tumors or widely metastatic tumors in bone, for example? But I think if the CRISPR fairy could grant that wish, it would be extremely important clinically.
Yeah, with that, I think this just leads me to say thank you very much for taking the time. I learned a lot. Yeah, it was real fun.
Great chatting with you, Marcus, and you as well, Kim. Good to see you.
Great as well. Thank you, Marcus and John. That was fun.
There it is, episode 13 of Forum. Thanks to both guests for making this happen. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can find it wherever you find your podcasts by searching for Nature Biotechnology and Forum. You'll also find our sister podcast, First Rounders, and our 10-part serial podcast, Hope Lies in Dreams, about the history of antisense, Stan Crook, and the disease spinal muscular atrophy. Okay, that is all. I will talk to you on the next forum. Thank you.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.